falling. I've been here all day. It's too hard to sleep. Time is running away. Feel like my soul has turned to steel. Still got the scars and the sun didn't let me heal. It's not even room enough. Dark yet, but it's getting there. Well, my sense of humanity is going down the drain. Behind every beautiful thing, there's been some kind of pain. She wrote me a letter, and she wrote. Down and right, what was in her mind? I just don't see why she'd even care. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there. Against my will, I know it looks like I'm moving, but I'm standing still. Every nerve in my body is so naked and numb. I can't even remember what it was I came here to get away from. Don't even hear the murmur of a prayer. It's not dark yet.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. That was Shelby Lynn and Allison Moore singing Dylan. My guest this month is Pamela J. Wallace, who is a sculptor, currently showing her work at the John Davis Gallery in Hudson, and also a teacher with the Bard Prison Initiative. After the interview, more Dylan, live at Newport in 1964, live at Town Hall in 1963, and then Joan Baez with Walls of Red Wing. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I'm here at the John Davis Gallery on Warren Street in Hudson with Pamela J. Wallace in among her work.
Yes, we are.
Welcome to the show, Pamela.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
One thing I'm always interested in is how you happen to be in this area.
Well, I initially came to this area because I went to Bard College, but I graduated a long time ago, and then I moved away to New York City and Boston, and then I moved back up here for a couple years, and then I moved away again to go to graduate school in Illinois. I went to Southern Illinois University at Carbondale for studied sculpture and metalworking, blacksmithing, and then I moved back here again. So I've come and gone a few times.
So how long have you been around?
I moved back this time in 1999.
So you've been here a good long time.
I have, yeah.
And so you studied art at Bard?
I studied art and sculpture at Bard College, and then after Bard, I continued working in my studio and working as a waitress and various other jobs. I worked as a carpenter for a while, and always having had a studio wherever I lived, I always had a studio. That was always the primary thing, was to have a studio, which is why waitressing was good, because I worked at night. So I would make art during the day and waitress at night. And then I worked as a carpenter for a while, and I realized I should just find a way to sort of buy time to make my art. And that's when I decided to go to graduate school.
What kind of carpentry?
Framing and some timber framing and also finished carpentry. So I did a lot of different things.
So was that something you had formal training in?
No, I learned how to work with my hands from my dad, because when I was a kid, one of the best ways to sort of have a connection or a relationship with my dad was to do the things that he did. So I would go down to the basement, and at one point I was a little kid, and he taught me how to use a bandsaw. I kind of don't really remember how old I was, but I know I stood up on a milk crate. So he wasn't really worried about my little fingers getting cut off, but somehow he was okay with that. So I made all sorts of things in bandsaw, and then I also did a lot of sewing as a kid, and that was a great way to connect with my mom, sewing and cooking. So I kind of had these two sides to my life as I was growing up, which was spending time with my dad doing the things the boys do and spending time with my mom doing things the girls do. And I think that really shows up in my work now, obviously, because I have all this work in this show that has sewn fabric, but I also have forged iron elements. Some of them are very small, and other ones are a little bit larger.
Those elements, you do the forging?
Yes, I do all the forging. So I make all the parts in all of my work. So I make all the elements, and then when I realized I needed to frame them, I also made the frames. So that's where my carpentry skills came back in again to help me complete the work.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up outside of Boston in Newton, Massachusetts. I grew up in my great-grandfather's house, which is the house that my father grew up in. So our basement was full of things that were my great-grandfather's things, and we had their old telephone, that kind that you pick up off the handle and you hold it up to your ear and you speak into this thing. We had all sorts of stuff in the basement.
All those generations of tools as well.
And yes, all of those tools and all of that stuff. And actually, there's a piece here which has a very small piece of fabric in it that's pinned to the surface. It's called Sailcloth Cloud Caught in Irons, and it's actually my great-grandfather's sail from his sailboat. He had a really tiny, sailboat. It was like a tiny little dinghy sailboat, and he had this sail that was in the basement. My dad thought one day, wow, Pamela could use this in her sculpture. Of course, it's a big sail compared to how little the piece is in the piece of fabric in the sculpture, and that's why the title says Caught in Irons, because sort of a pun on sailboats.
Now, when you say you forge these metal elements, how do you go about doing that?
So I have a forge that I built in my studio. So I have a studio. My husband and I actually built our own house. We started in 2002, and we moved in 2005. We literally built it ourselves. A third guy helped us, the three of us. And I still had my job teaching, because I taught at SUNY New Paltz for about 14 years in the art department as a part-time employee. And my husband is a carpenter full-time. So we would do these other carpentry jobs, and then weekends and at the end of the day, we would build our own house. So we do live in our own house, and then we also built our own studio. When I was in graduate school in Illinois, I bought the tools and equipment for blacksmithing and metalworking. So I brought all that back east with me. And now in our studio, we have a blacksmithing studio, and then my husband had a whole wood shop. And so we have two rooms for that, and then he and I each have our own private studios where we don't share the space, but we share the blacksmithing studio and the wood shop. And so the blacksmithing equipment is mostly things that I bought when I was in Illinois. There are a lot of auctions there, a lot of farms selling their tools. I have a small power hammer, which is called the Little Giant Power Hammer. So the hammer does all the work for me, But I also have a few anvils, and I have a forge that I built in a workshop with some other friends.
So you heat up this hunk of metal and then
heat up the metal till it's like orange yellow hot, and then hammer it on an anvil. And some of them I used on the in the power hammer, but then when they're really small, I do that all by hand. I mean, really small. Basically, is everything in here is small.
Right, just for reference, they're an inch or two long.
Yes, some of them are. The one over there is 6 or 7 inches. This is probably the smallest body of work I've ever made. I did make an installation in here, I think it was 2013, in John's elevator shaft, which is right here in this space. And that was, whatever that is, 32 feet tall by, how big is this, 15 by 18? Maybe 15 by 18 by about 32 or 36 feet tall. Because the elevator shaft is 4 stories, and it's very open.
What were the materials in that piece?
That was mixed media. There was 2-inch rope, which was to match the rope that is used on the elevator already. I made it very site-specific. And so then there were forged brackets that held the rope, and then the rope, at the bottom of the rope were pieces, were brackets that suspended plaster spheres. I made about 8-inch diameter plaster spheres that were suspended throughout the space. There were probably 20 ropes that came straight down and then suspended a sphere, and on the bottom it was gravel. And on the very top, I had large wooden beams that I had cut. Because I worked for a timber framer back before I went to graduate school, I learned how to cut timbers. And so I cut the timbers and drilled holes in them, and that would hold the rope, and then the rope suspended the spheres, if that makes sense. So
it must have been fun to put together.
It was really fun to put together. I love doing all this. I mean, I just, it keeps me sane working in my studio. I feel like I would go crazy if I didn't make art. So I really enjoy it, even though it's not like it's always easy. It's often can be a struggle to figure out what you're doing, or why am I making this, or what should happen next, or what should I work on next.
Now, have you worked in this particular style for some time?
If people see the work, they'll say, oh, they recognize it as my work. But it's changing, definitely. I started working with this abaca paper, which is a big part of the work here.
Which kind of paper?
It's called abaca paper, A-B-A-C-A. And that's a kind of fiber. And I started working at this when I had a residency at the Women's Studio Workshop in Rosendale. And I loved the material, and so I've been working with it since then. So I go there and make the paper and make flat sheets. And it's wet, and then while it's wet, I stretch it over an armature, or I stretch it over wood. So these are like paper trays or boxes, and like that's, you know, some of them are stretched over wood, but then I take it off the wood, and then it becomes like a paper tray or paper box. And so then I make my sculptures inside that. So they've all got slightly, the abaca paper has different color depending on how long I let it sit around, because it starts to change a little bit while it's wet. But once it's dry, it's stable. It doesn't change anymore.
How did you make that discovery?
I made a bunch of paper, and then I didn't have time to use it, and I waited a few months, and then I saw that the color had changed. It's almost like it's alive, you know, it's a plant still, even though you make a pulp out of it, so you put it in this beater and you beat it, and that's how they make paper. And I don't have a beater like that, which is why I go over to Women's Studio Workshop and rent their studio to make it. And they are incredible. They're such a great space, such a great resource. I recommend anybody go over there and try to take classes or apply for the residency. They're really fantastic. And so anyway, I go over there and beat the paper, the pulp into paper, and then I make the flat sheets. And then because it sat around for a while, I saw that the color changed a little bit.
Which gives it a very nice quality.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I really like the way each piece, the paper is different. And this piece we're looking at right here, it's both of those kinds of paper are the abaca, but one is much older. The one further back is much older, and the one in the front is very new. So, but once it's dry, it won't change anymore.
It looks almost like that sheepskin paper.
It does, and I really like the fact that it looks like animal skin or like hide of some kind. So when I first started making sculpture in 85, when I was an undergraduate in college, I was the first artist that really influenced me just like crazy. The first few artists, well, one of them was Eva Hesse, who's just so fantastic. And so I was really interested in the way she used material and the resins she used, but then when I discovered how bad those resins were for me, I realized I couldn't use that stuff. I didn't want to risk. It's bad enough when you at work as a carpenter, the things you're exposed to. I didn't need to add any more bad chemicals when I'm in the studio. She used a polyester resin, which some people think may have caused the tumor that led to her death. I don't know if that. I saw the film that's made about her, which is fantastic, and they don't really say that caused it, but it seems like she was really exposed to a lot of that chemical, a lot of that resin, which is really toxic. So, but I love that color and that surface. And when I discovered the Abaca paper, there's a similar. I'm drawn to it in the way I was drawn always to Eva Hesse's work. I mean, I'm not trying to make Eva Hesse's work, but she's such a big influence on what I make, along with a lot of other artists. You know, I would say I'm really influenced by Martin Puryear and Magdalena Abakanovic, Ursula von Radingsvard, Paul Klee, who's a painter, Tapies, who's a painter / sculptor. You know, there's so many on the list I could name.
Yeah, I could see a little Klee in your work.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely. I love his paintings. When I discovered that, too, when I first started making art in 85 or 84, I was just, oh, my God. Made me think, maybe I should be a painter, but I'm so materials-based, and it didn't really occur to me when I first started making sculpture that I had been making sculpture pretty much my whole life by making things standing on a milk crate in the basement with the bandsaw, or making candles, or sewing things for people, or sewing things for myself, and initially I was a real little kid sewing. I was, you know, my sister, I did everything my sister did, so she was taking sewing lessons, I had to take sewing lessons. And I was so small, I couldn't reach the pedal, so they had to put a block under it. And we made all our own clothes for a while, my sister and I. We had such a blast doing it. I really, really loved doing it. And then I stopped, you know, I sewed always to fix my clothes or alter them to fit me or whatever. But then it was probably only about 10 or 12 years ago that I started using fabric in my work. And it's only in this body of work that I've used fabric quite extensively in the work. So it's like the mix, I think, you know, women's work and men's work, the women's work of those things traditionally we think of as women's work, and then the men's work traditionally, forging and blacksmithing was men's work, and carpentry and all of that. But I just sort of bring my own style to it, I guess. Our parents are, you know, such a big influence on us, there's no doubt. And my grandfather did carpentry also, and my great-grandfather was always fixing his sailboat, which was, as I said, this little small boat, but he would have it out on sawhorses in the yard, and he'd be patching it. Actually, interestingly enough, he was patching it with polyester resin, which is the stuff that Eva Hesse used. So as a kid, I was helping him use polyester resin to patch the boat, which is meanwhile then what I came to start be so drawn to in Eva Hesse's work as she used it as sculpture.
And so you went to Bard, and then you said you took some time off before starting.
Yes, I took 7 years off. I lived in New York City, and I just worked in my studio. And I went to museums. I went to some galleries, too, but I got really discouraged by what was in the galleries at the time in the 80s in New York. I just didn't relate to anything. I never saw anything that was even remotely like what I was interested in making. So I stopped going to galleries, and I just went to museums. And I ended up looking at older work. And occasionally there'd be an artist that I would see that would be a contemporary artist that I thought was really interesting. And now there's many contemporary artists that I think are really interesting. But I was, you know, I didn't know my way around the art world at all. I still don't really. I just make my work and do what I can, do the best I can do. But showing with John Davis has been amazing. I've been showing with him since 2010, or I guess my first solo show here was in 2011. And he's shown had a solo show with me every 2 years, and he considers this a solo show just because the space is big enough that it really is a solo show. It's not
right.
Like
we're here in the first floor of the carriage house, so called, which is 700-800 square feet. At least.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I have 14 sculptures in this show, so it's not like a group show where you have one or two things in there. So John's just been incredibly supportive. He's such a great gallerist and so enthusiastic about art. And just, I feel so fortunate to be working with him. And I really value and treasure that.
Now, when did you start teaching?
I started teaching. So part of why I went to graduate school was, initially was to buy time to make art and also to find out whether I liked teaching or not. And they had a, so the school I went to was, I chose the school because I got a full tuition waiver and I got a graduate teaching scholarship. So I was able to teach my first semester there. I started teaching as an assistant to a professor. And then later I had my own classes. And I wanted to find out if I liked teaching because I wanted to find out another way to earn a living because I realized doing carpentry until I'm retired would just wear me out. And I didn't have the energy to make art the way I did with waitressing. Because with waitressing, you use your good energy during the day, and then at night you're tired, but it doesn't take a lot of brain power to be a waitress, for at least for me. I love waitresses. I don't mean to put down waitresses. But, you know, it didn't take the kind of focus I needed to make my work. But then after a while, that got too tiring. But carpentry was exhausting, and it was hard to make work unless I made it on the weekends, and I always had to earn a living. So then I thought, well, maybe graduate school would be good. I'll buy time. If I've got a tuition waiver, I won't have a huge student loan debt. Of course, I had to take out student loans to pay my living expenses, so I still have a student loan that I'm still paying off to this day. But it's very small compared to what it would have been if I had gone. You know, I was really interested in staying in New York and maybe going somewhere in New York, but I just couldn't afford the tuition and the expenses. So Southern Illinois had this great tuition waiver. And they also had a huge studio, bigger than any studio I saw at any school I visited. I looked at California and Los Angeles and San Francisco because I wanted to be in a city. I really didn't want to be in the middle of the Midwest. But the huge studio, the facilities, they had an incredible wood shop, incredible ceramics department, and they had a blacksmithing degree. And so I was very interested in blacksmithing. I had taken a few classes at a school in North Carolina called Penland School, and blacksmithing was so exciting to me. I had done welding in college, but I didn't know anything about manipulating metal in the way that you can when you heat it and it becomes malleable like clay. Of course, it's hard. It's a lot harder than clay, but it's movable in similar ways, and it's so strong and sturdy, and I like rusty metal, and I like blackened metal, and I just was really interested. So when I first went to graduate school, I got my degree in sculpture, and then I applied to the blacksmithing program, and I got a second MFA in blacksmithing. And I was the only woman in the blacksmithing program, and I told them initially that I wanted to be in the program. When I applied and they interviewed me, I said I didn't want to make functional blacksmithing work. I did not want to make fireplace grates and garden gates and tools. It's not what I wanted to make. I wanted to make sculpture. And they actually were very open to that and very excited, even though much of the program really was functional work. But I don't make functional work. But they were perfectly happy to have me in the program, and that was fantastic. They embraced me, and they were really, really great, really supportive. And it was so I ended up staying in graduate school for 3.5 years because I did 2 MFAs. I don't usually tell people I have a master's in blacksmithing because then they get the idea that I'm a functional blacksmith or I'm going to shoe a horse or something, which I'm not going to do. I don't know how to shoe horses. I don't know how to go near a horse. But
you use acetylene torches and things like that.
Yes, I do. So I also did a lot of welding and I studied welding. I went to a local technical college and took welding classes where you would go in there and weld 2 nights a week for 3 hours, and all you do was run beads and weld, because I wanted to master welding so that when I make my art, I wasn't struggling with that technique while I'm working. I mean, there's tons of parts in this show that are welded, and people might not even know how I put it together, but because sometimes I use gas welding, which would be for very small things, and if I need to TIG weld, I'll do that, and if I need to arc weld, I'll do that. And if I need to MIG weld, I'll do that. So I can do all of those different kinds of welding in my studio.
Most of which are unknown to me.
Yeah, right. I'm sure most people, but yeah.
Well, what are the differences in some of these techniques?
Well, gas welding is the oxyacetylene. It's a torch. It's a flame. So you can just do smaller things. Mostly you weld steel. MIG welding is like the hot glue gun of welding. It's very easy to do. You kind of press a trigger and and it happens.
How do you spell that? M?
M-I-G. Capital M, capital I, capital G. And then TIG welding is capital T, capital I, capital G, which means tungsten inert gas. So they all stand for something. But TIG welding would be a much lower heat, but very similar to gas welding in that you have a feeder rod and you have a torch. But the torch has an electric arc on it. Torch handle has an electric arc. And it's got a gas shielding it. So, which is the inert gas, tungsten inert gas, and that's an argon CO2 gas. Anyway, we don't have to get too technical about it. But the TIG welding allows you to weld many different kinds of metals. So I could be welding bronze, or I could be welding stainless steel or aluminum. But I tend to not use those materials very much. I tend to mostly work in steel or iron. So the gas welding works really well for me.
And when you get the raw material, what does it look like?
It's just bar stock, just plain, like, say, a 1-inch by 1-inch by 16-foot long bar, or a quarter-inch by quarter-inch by 16-foot long, or depending on the kind of steel, or it's 11 feet long, depending on the kind of steel.
And is that something you can get without traveling very far?
I can get it delivered from a steel supplier in Albany. And actually, I knew a guy that had a garage in Tivoli. He bought a garage in Tivoli, a gas station garage that was no longer being used. And in the back of that, he had tons of really old metal, which was probably from the 60s or 70s or something. And so my husband and I bought all of that metal, or a lot of that metal from him at a very, very low price. So then we made steel racks in our studio, and it's all stored there. So we actually hardly ever have to buy any metal. We saw it all, and we realized it would be a lot of work to move this, you know, 4 tons of metal or 2 tons, I don't know how much it was a huge amount of metal, but in bar stock form, so we could carry it in smaller bundles, put it on the truck, and drive it to our studio. So we have a lot stored. Luckily, we found that because it really saved a lot of money, and it means we just have it on hand.
Now, from what John was telling me, you live in a sort of a wetlands area?
Yes. We bought, so in 2002, we bought land that is mostly wetland. It's a large parcel of land, but most of it's wetland. And so in order to build there, we had to get DEC approvals because it's a labeled wetland. But there was enough buildable land for us to build a house.
So is that sort of near the Rojan?
It is near the Rojan, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was heavily wooded, so we first cut down the trees, and then we stuck 4 posts in the ground and kept shifting them around, sitting there in lawn chairs. How's the sun? What room do we want the sun to come in? And, you know, slowly, I remember sitting out there thinking, well, how are we going to get the roof on this? How are we going to do all this? My husband, Steve, is just so clear-headed and great. And he's like, let's just think about where the corners will go. When we get to the roof, we'll worry about the roof. When we get to the, and he just takes things moment by moment. He's really, it's great to work with him. And he's having a show here opening on August 19th. He'll be on the top floor of this carriage house, which is a beautiful room also. So he's a sculptor also.
Were you living nearby when you were doing the construction?
We were living in a barn in Red Hook. Yep. In a beautiful old barn that we loved in Red Hook. We almost didn't want to move out of it, but we really wanted to have our own house, and we really wanted to have our own studio. So it took a long time, and the studio is only just been finished. My husband actually finished it by himself this past fall. I mean, I helped a little. I helped with the roof a little bit and other things. But and it's really not finished, but it's finished enough. There's no trim and there's no siding on it, but we'll get to that eventually. So that's, you know, we started in 2002, and 2017 the studio just got finished. So it's been a really long process, but when you do everything yourself, it takes a long time.
And but, you also, everything is worked out over a long period, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Yes, yes. We start, as we worked in it, we thought, oh, we should do this, we should do that. And so then we planned it with the possibility. We don't have any plumbing in our studio. We have a rainwater system that we use to wash our hands. We have a big sink, and we just have a bucket full of rainwater and then a bucket under the sink that we fill. When the bucket gets full, we drain it outside. And we have a composting outhouse outside. So we could always walk back to the house, but if we're back there, you know, we have the water we need, and we have drinking water.
It's fairly close to the house, I assume.
Yeah, it's about 800 feet away. And we have a big bottle of drinking water that, you know, sits on a stand. So we have drinking water back there. And we figure if we ever have to live there, then we'll have to dig a well, and we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. We can you know, our plan initially was to sell our house, build it and sell it so we could afford to keep going. And then we built the house and we were exhausted. And we said, well, we'll just move in for a little while. And then you move into this thing that you built with your hands. And then you feel like you don't ever want to leave it. We love our house, but that's an open door to be able to sell it and then move into the top of the studio if we have to, or build another house, or who knows.
And so when did you start teaching at Bard?
So in 2012, I was still at SUNY New Paltz, and I had just applied to teach one class for the Bard Prison Initiative. And I had heard about the program, and I really believe in that idea of educating people who are
incarcerated. And so where do you teach in the prison?
Yes, I teach in the prison. So we have our program, we have six prisons that are that we work in our program. And one of them is Coxsackie Correctional, which is right on the other side of the river here. And so in my program, I have about 17 or 18 students at Coxsackie Correctional. And I work with them a two-year cycle with that cohort. So they take the full college classes that is exactly the same as Bard College. Their degree is exactly the same
as
Bard College.
And so what's included then in terms of the various classes?
So they take like a first-year seminar class, which is basically any kind of first-year seminar in any college. They take anthropology and literature and history and philosophy, and they take an art class. And so that's the class I teach, is drawing classes. And so the cohort that is at Coxsackie would take one drawing course over 2 years, the same as what's required. Oh, there's a bird in here. The same as what's required in a regular college program. So they take the full course load, just like any college program, and their degree is exactly the same as my degree at Bard College will be the same as theirs. So when I first started, I taught one course, and it was the most incredible thing. I mean, I had a room full of 13 students then, and every single one of them was engaged and interested and worked really hard. I never had a course anywhere I taught, and I taught at Mount Holyoke Sabbatical Placement a few times, and I've taught at a bunch of community colleges in Illinois and at SUNY New Paltz, and I had great students everywhere, but these students, every single one in the class was absolutely focused and interested and engaged and appreciative and respectful and brilliant. They're really amazing.
And how old were these guys?
They're probably between, I don't really know, I don't ask their age, 19 and 40 maybe, or 19 and 45. And they're so smart. And you know, our philosophy and history and literature professors come out of there saying the same thing. And math. We have so many math majors in the program. And it's all privately funded. And, there should be college and prison nationwide, because people who go through our program, the recidivism rate is 2 to 4%, I think, whereas nationwide it's 40 to 60%, and it costs the same amount of money to educate someone at Harvard in 1 year as it does to keep a man or woman incarcerated for 1 year. So our taxes would go down if we supported college and prison programs. And of course, we have a problem in this country with mass incarceration. So it would really, really help. You know, help humans. You know, we are a Christian nation. Shouldn't we be about forgiveness and all of that? And people can change and grow, and these guys get out and they become good standing members of society, and they pay their taxes, and they, you know, it's...
And they have a degree from Bard.
And they'll have a degree from Bard, which is the same exact degree. If they go all the way through the BA, they will have the same degree at Bard College. They start with an associate's degree, an AA degree. And then if they want to go on to get the BA, they apply for the BA. And so I teach the once in 2 years I teach at Coxsackie, but then I teach at some of the other jails that we have. We have six jails. I've taught at all of them. Yeah, it's a really great program.
Was something you sought out.
I sought out initially to teach one class. They hired me to teach one class, and they said, well, just one class, because I think they're always checking to see if you can do it, if you're a good teacher, if you can handle the situation. It's a very stressful thing to walk into jail. You really are locked in, and there's nothing scary about it, because the students are, it's so much work to get into the program, to stay in the program. You have to have people that are very, very engaged, and they're totally not threatening. They're so grateful and appreciative. In fact, you know, they're just so kind. It's incredible. They're so glad that we're there teaching them.
So, in other words, they're going through a similar kind of admission screening as any other student would.
Absolutely, yeah. And they probably have more issues around learning how to write and spelling or grammar and things like that. So we teach grammar classes. I don't think they teach a grammar class on Bard campus, but we teach a grammar class through BPI. And a lot of people have been out of school, or a lot of people got a GED and not a high school diploma, or have been out of school for a long time, and they're rusty in remembering these things. But we really emphasize writing. And it's a liberal arts education, which is why they have to take a drawing class, but writing is the main focus. We really, really teach them how to write and really make that clear that that's a very, very important thing for them to know how to do. And, of course, they learn how to use a computer, and we have a library there, and we don't have internet access for the students because prison inmates can't have internet access. But they have a computer which can access a full library that you would have in your library, JSTOR, and all the resources that you would have in any library. So they can research, do research and all that. So I also do a lot of drawing. I don't have much drawing in this show, although some of the pieces have a little bit of graphite marks. And I do these, like I said, these are small sculptures, but I also do installations, as I mentioned. I've done some outdoor work, not too much outdoor work.
On your website, I saw some of the graphite
drawings, yep.
So this is what you do.
Yeah, full-time artist and part-time teacher. So I don't know how that all works. I work a lot, but I really enjoy it. I love making art. Like I said, I don't think I could get by without doing it. But I also really love teaching, and I love the interaction with my students. And I need to earn a paycheck. I mean, I don't earn a paycheck off my work. I would love to sell more work, but I also want to make what I want to make. I can't make commissions or things like that. It just doesn't work for me. I'd rather go teach because I do love teaching. And occasionally my husband will have a carpenter job that he needs help on, and I'll go, you know, instead of going to the studio or that day, maybe I'll go work for him doing carpentry. And I have done that. When I worked at SUNY New Paltz, occasionally I would take a semester off. He had a really big carpentry job, and actually a carpentry job that essentially paid for the first half of our studio. It was a little over a year-long job. And so I took one semester off and worked for him full-time as a carpenter, so that we could earn the money to then build our studio. And then I went back to SUNY New Paltz. So I guess it was my sabbatical, you could call it that, except I worked as a carpenter the whole time. So I've had a lot of jobs, different jobs since then, and I feel like every one of them has helped me in my sculpture, which is great.
Yeah, these various skills.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the work is beautiful.
Thank you. I'm very happy with this show. I'd love to get it into another gallery or another show somewhere, and I'm kind of working on that. Like I said, I'm not really connected in the art world, so I'm not sure how to make that happen, but I'm doing my best.
You had a show in Albany at some museum space?
Yes, I was in the Hudson Mohawk Regional, which was at SUNY Albany, and I had a large installation in that show, so it was a submission process. I submitted images of this large installation, which is, I guess it's 15 feet tall by, in that space, I think it was 20 feet wide, and then it's installed right flat on the wall with large plaster spheres and rope, and I also had these steel circles that I soldered sewing pins to the back of the circle so I could kind of plug them into the sheetrock on the wall. So they kind of pressed right into the wall. So it was almost like drawing and sculpture, and there was some graphite marks on the wall too. And it only came off the wall about 8 or 10 inches. So that was a big installation I did for that show.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been really nice speaking with you too.
So thank you very much, Pamela.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
He was born in Duluth, but his family lived up in a little mining town. As he said, he ran away from home 17 times and got brought back 16. At any rate, I don't think anybody needs to talk for him if Bob Dylan is within hearing distance. I hope he comes forward. Where is he? Bob, you are sitting back there.
Thank you. Yes, yes. I hear you well. I think you have the wrong man. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man. Please play a song for me. Upon your magic swirling ship, my senses have been stripped, my hands can't feel to grip, my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I am ready to go anywhere, I'm ready far to fade into my own parade. Cast your dance and spill my way, I promise to go under it. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. Yes, to dance beneath a diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me in the jingle jangle morning. I'll come following you. My darling young one, I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw highway diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with hammers a-bleeding. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands was a-blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sounds of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rains are gonna fall. Oh, who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? And who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman, her body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. And what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back out before the rain starts a-falling. I walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and the hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison. And the executioner's face is always well hidden, where the hunger is ugly, where the souls are forgotten, where black is the color, where none is the number. And I tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, rain.
Oh, the age of the inmates I remember quite freely. Cast off like criminals inside the walls of Red Wing. From the dirty old mess hall, you march to the brick wall, too weary to talk and too tired to sing. Takes you to the screen. Farewell to the minutes, they threaten you with it. Inside the walls of Red Wing. on the bunkhouse shingles, and the sounds in the night, they make Crossroads.